Claire, and you're listening to the Mother Love Podcast, a show where we talk about the journey of parenting. This is a space where guests open their hearts, gather their courage, and tell the truth about what it means to care for these messy and delightful little ones in today's big, wide, and often overwhelming world. We talk about the pressures, the steep learning curves, and the bittersweet reality of watching our children grow. Parenting asks us to be willing to feel it all, celebration and grief, joy and anguish, fear and courage. So take a breath, let these stories wash over you, and show yourself a little love. Hey everybody, thanks for being here. I am so happy to have Ashley Watson on today. Ashley's story is just incredible, and some of the things that she and her family have been through are just, they've just been through so many challenges. So I'm really excited to have you on today to share your story, Ashley, and maybe you can just take a moment to say hi to our audience and tell us a little bit about your family as it is today.
Perfect. Yeah. Yeah. So today I am a homeschooling mom of three kiddos, two of which are on the spectrum and have autism. And one, my little youngest little boy, has a rare craniofacial disorder or syndrome that he was born with. We have a chaotic household. I wouldn't have it any other way. It's definitely neurospicy up in these parts.
Neurospicy. I love that. That's great.
Yeah. My kid's dad and I divorced when my youngest was two, and I have since remarried to a wonderful man that has embraced all of our chaos and also brought some of his own. He has four children. They're all grown now, but still young adults. And so one actually lives with us. And so we just have like this giant, chaotic, lovely family. So,
oh, that's great. I love that you described them that way. And maybe can you tell us the ages of your three?
Yeah. So my oldest, Ellie, she is 9. And like I like to say, she's always very particular to tell people she's almost 9 and a half. She'll be 10 in just August. You know, it's right around the corner. Scarlett is 7. She's about to be 8 in March. And then Jace just turned 6 in January.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so in your makeup of ages, your kiddos came all pretty like boom, bam, boom.
They did.
And I know that that would be intense for any mom and family to have kiddos so close together like you did. But for you, there was like a moment in time when all these things sort of merged together and happened all at once. And so maybe you can kind of just, let's just start there. And I think that will naturally kind of take us into knowing more about Jace's story in particular.
Yeah. So Ellie and Scarlett are 19 months apart. And so I'm the kind of person, I want my kids close because if I got out of the sleepless nights and the diapers, I couldn't have gone back, you know? So I was like, I'm just gonna bam, you know, I like, you know, so that was our, you know, kind of a game plan. And we just had the two girls and we really were going to stick with two. I wanted three and he was kind of iffy, my ex-husband, but he really wanted a boy. And to me, it didn't really matter, you know, even if we had a third and it was a girl, that would have been our last two. But we decided to try for a third. And so Jace was 22 months younger, is 22 months younger than Scarlett. And so it's boom, bam, boom, like you said. And so when Jace was born in January of 2018, Scarlett was 2 months shy of being two. And then Ellie was just 3 and a half. And Jace was unexpectedly born with Apert syndrome. So we didn't have any clue that he had kind of a super rare, pretty intensive craniofacial syndrome at all until the moment that they laid him on my chest. We did have some, so like at my anatomy scan at 20 weeks or so, there was a time where they couldn't see his kidneys. And then there was like a part of his heart that they couldn't really see. And I remember them just being like, oh, he's a little small, you know, still. So it just might be that he's too small to be able to see these kinds of things just yet. So we'll wait a few weeks. And I just left there, you know, I wasn't worried at all. It was just, you know, he was too little. So about 3 weeks later, I was about 23, 24 weeks. I went back in. And I was so unworried. I didn't even bring anybody with me because that's how, you know, I was just reassured that he was going to be fine. And at that appointment, his kidneys, they were there. They were able to see those, and that was all fine. And then there was still a piece of his heart that they said they couldn't quite see clearly, but that he was healthy and fine, and you know, they had no concerns, and he might just need a checkup. And in my mind, I feel like I was kind of feeling like, you know, like my brother had like a heart murmur, you know, just a benign heart murmur when he was younger. And it's just, you know, lots of kids do, and they kind of grow out of it. I wasn't expecting anything crazy. I was just like, well, he's, you know, he's fine. It's just too small in this little area. It might be nothing. So I left, and I didn't really even think a lot about it. I didn't think twice.
Yeah. Do you think it would have been different if Jace was your first? Like, you know how...
Yes.
With our first pregnancies, everything is like, oh my gosh, are they okay? Oh my gosh, did I eat the wrong salami? Oh my god, like, yeah, like everything was so. And I wonder if just too. This being your third baby, you were like, oh, it's fine, it's cool, like,
yeah, I definitely think so. I think so in a lot of ways it would have been different, but that particular, I think I would avoid more. You also have more time when you don't have a babies yet, you know, to like kind of occupy your time. And I definitely was busy, but I think so. I think I would have like taken that more to like, you know, is he okay? Am I, you know what I mean? It was kind of a weird thing to even, I'd never had that with my girls at all. I never had like, were they were too small. So like, I don't know. I definitely think it would have been different. Like had I not been this busy mom or like just completely exhausted, you know?
Yeah. So then, sorry, I kind of interjected, but so then you were at this next checkup or ultrasound and.
Yeah. And so everything was good. They just said his kidneys looked fine. There is a piece of his heart that we still can't see, but he's, you know, healthy, and we don't think it's going to affect anything currently. You know, we'll just check him after birth. And so I didn't leave there thinking that there was going to be anything major. I thought at most, maybe just like a heart murmur or something, you know, easily fixable. In my mind, I was, you know.
Right.
It was good. So flash forward to about 37 weeks. And I remember, this is something I forgot to kind of mention, but 37 weeks, my OB did like a quick ultrasound every appointment, which was really cool because you could see your baby every time. And it wasn't like an anatomy scan at all. It was just a quick little ultrasound. And sometimes you got pictures and sometimes they wouldn't, you know, cooperate or whatever. But I remember that 37-week appointment and my OB, who he had delivered all of my kids, and he paused at the, he was looking at Jace's little face, and he paused for a moment longer than needed, you know, but, and I remember I have a picture of Jace's face because he looked like the grumpiest little man that you have ever seen. Like he was just so pouty and his little lips were just like, he looked like he was so mad that he was still in there. And, but I remember that, like looking back, of course, like in that moment, like you clock it, but you don't really, you know what I mean? And it was just like, oh, he's so cute. He's so grumpy. He printed the picture. And then it was maybe like 2 days later, I was visiting some friends and I felt kind of like a little gush. I wouldn't even consider it a gush. It was more like a, I felt like I peed myself maybe a little bit. It wasn't even enough to like wet my pants. And so I was like, you know, three kids in, I was like, you know, there's some weird stuff that happens. you know, things are not, you know, it's been through a lot in the last 3 years. So I was like, well, maybe I just, you know, maybe it kicked me extra hard and I peed a little bit. And so I went home thinking really nothing of it. I had went to the bathroom and kind of cleaned myself up and stuff. And, but over like the next 2 days, it's not like I was dripping water. It wasn't like anything like that, but I just felt off a little bit. I felt like maybe I was just a little bit more, I guess, damp than normal. That's a little TMI, I know, but.
No, this is a mothering podcast. We all know.
So I was like, I remember I was cooking dinner. I had Scarlett at the time on my hip, and my husband walked in and from work. And I was like, you know, I think it's nothing. I think I'm just going to go to the hospital and they're going to basically tell me that I'm leaking urine. And that's normal, but I'm going to go in and just double check because I just don't feel quite, you know, I just want to get it checked. But I remember we cooked dinner. I fed the girls. I might have even helped them get ready for bed. And then I left all by myself. I went to the hospital and went into the triage and I was convinced. I told the nurse on hand. I was like, you know, I'm convinced I'm peeing myself, but I just want to double check. And it ended up being water. Like, Jace's water had broke, which didn't happen with my girls at all. They actually had to break my water. But his water had broke, and then his head clogged up the, you know, had clamped down suction so that a little bit was leaking very slowly, but I didn't get that big gush because immediately he just kind of suctioned. And so, but because I hadn't been in labor.
Happening before.
I guess it's pretty common, like decently common, like not like super, super common.
Uh-huh.
But I've heard, like, since it's happened to me, I've talked to a few people that's happened to, where like their water broke, but it was either a small rupture where, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And then their head was so low that it just kind of, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I wasn't in labor at all. But because it had been over like 24 hours since that original rupture, they had to induce me because there's like a risk of infection and all that. And so we had to arrange for care for, I think my mom and my sister drove over. My sister watched my girls. My husband came and my mom came to the hospital. And I think they started my Pitocin around 11 or so that night. And I went in after dinner. So like around 11 or so at night. And then I think around 1 is when I started to have contractions. And I know that, you know, there's so many horror stories of Pitocin for people. And thankfully, I didn't really have that. I think that my body, even though I wasn't in labor, my water was ruptured and this was my third baby. So it did go really relatively good. I did get an epidural for all three. So that definitely helps for that. But, and then at like 5, I always mix up Scarlett and Jace. One of them was born at 7 and one of them was born at 5 in the morning. And I almost think that Jace was born earlier because it was a really long day. So we're just going to go with that. He's born at 5 in the morning. And, you know, we had no expectations besides a healthy little boy. And I remember the doctor was like, we were right there as pushing. And he's like, he's just stuck a little bit behind your pubic bone. Really bear down. We'll get him out here in the next push. And I did. And, you know, they grab him with the blanket and stuff. And the doctor just kind of puts them on your chest, right? Like, just like lays them down.
Yeah.
And they get to work doing what they're going to do for you.
Yeah.
And so he was still covered up and the nurses were rubbing him and stuff. And I remember when the doctor had first taken him out, he said, oh, we got a cone head, you know, because that happens sometimes with babies' heads being, you know, that's a small space to come out of.
Yeah.
But it was such a surreal moment. I looked down and I went to put my finger in his hand.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this moment where, because up to this point, there was like my expectation was just that he was going to be okay. You know, he'd had all the scans, he was going to be okay. And I went to put my finger on his hand and I almost felt like, why is this film over his hand? Like because his hands were born as mittens. So this one kind of looked like this with his, he had a little pinky free. And then this one was a total mitten. So it was like this and it was all fused with skin, but also bone was fused together. So, and they were adorable. But I remember in that moment, I didn't know what was happening. Like, it was such and I was like, what's going on with his hand? Like, and I tried to rub it away. I tried to rub this film away. And then that's when all hell broke loose. But there was, there was a small moment in time right after I said that, that the world just, I feel like it just stopped. It just, it went quiet. And I know it was only a second. It was only a second before those doctors and nurses flipped into action. But for me, it was like an eternity. It's just this. And so, and then I don't know what kind of bird call they holler into the hallway or what button they push. But all of a sudden, like, we were flooded with people. There was just all kinds of, the whole NICU team came down. The nurse or the doctor was there. And his resident had been there the whole time. And they had a little, like, bassinet next to the table. And thankfully, they were just able to take him right there. So I was just right there. He was at the, you know, he was having a little bit of a hard time breathing because with Apert syndrome, it makes your, along with everything else, it makes your midface bones too small. So it affects the way all this grows. And so his nasal passages and stuff were very small and almost obsolete, honestly, when he was first born. So he was struggling a little bit. But they were able to just keep him right there and give him some blow-by oxygen, which is like just the mask where they blow in oxygen. And he was doing great. Like he came around. And then I remember this NICU doctor, she was like a veteran NICU doctor. She'd been doing it for years. And I'm so thankful that on that night she was working, or day, not even night, early yeah. morning, that she was working, because I think I would have had a different experience with someone who wasn't as experienced with these kinds of like events. She allowed me to then hold him again. Mm-hmm. And in that, so that was the first time, besides being, you know, he got whisked away, he was at the bassinet, I was listening to him over there, but I felt so helpless. I couldn't even get up because I had the epidural. So they brought him back over, and I have a picture of that moment when they're about to give him back to me. And I think I sent that one to you, but it's like, mm-hmm. I stumbled across it maybe like a year after Jace was born. It took me a while to go kind of through that stuff. In the very beginning, like I had some stuff on my camera and like my phone stuff I went through right away, but I don't know, stuff on the camera I just didn't get to. But there was a picture my mom snapped when they were bringing him back over, and I was just reaching for him. I just wanted him so badly to be with me. I wanted him to know that he was okay. And and my husband at the time was standing there, and you could just see the emotion on, you know, through his body of what was happening. But he laid on my chest. Yeah.
Photos are interesting that way when you look at them. And
Right. And like, you don't see it that way, but when you kind of see it in a picture form, you're like, wow, it's just really impactful.
Like, the body language of the people involved says so much in a picture. Yeah.
Right. But so they gave him to me, and he was so hungry, even though he was having a hard time breathing. He's been hungry since the minute he came out. He's so hungry. And Danielle was like, we can let him try to eat if he, you know, like, and I feel like a less experienced nurse would be like, you know, this is too risky, or, you know, but she was like, we have him all hooked up. Let's look at his stats. You know, he's hungry. Let's just see how he does. And he ate for a couple minutes, like he latched and he ate, and he had to keep unlatching and latch because of the way he was having a hard time, like regulating breathing and eating at the same time.
Yeah, totally.
But so eventually she was like, you know, I think we'll have to figure this out. He really wants to eat, but we're going to take him down to the NICU and make sure everything is good, and you can come down when you're ready. And he was so mad. Was so mad.
Yeah,
I think he was more mad that he couldn't eat. Yeah, he was more mad that he couldn't eat than he was that he couldn't breathe, you know? Like, and I think that's been consistent his whole life.
He's like, it's fine if I need oxygen, but don't take away my food.
Right. Like, no. Like, even nowadays in surgeries, when he comes out of anesthesia, I have to tell them he's going to look like he's in pain. And I said, he's hungry. Like, that's so before we, like, you know, I'm not totally not against pain medicine. Like, he goes through the major stuff. But I was like, before we really think, oh my gosh, we need to up his pain medicine, I said, wait till he can eat. And almost every single time, he's like a totally different kid. As soon as he can eat, they're like, oh my God. Like, like, I know. He's a hangry boy.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah.
Yeah, but so they took him, they wheeled him down to the NICU, and I couldn't go right away. My husband at the time was able to go, and he followed him down. But I, you know, they were doing all the stuff, you know, the weird belly massage that they do after to make sure everything, like, did they do that to you? Like, the aggressive belly massage?
I wouldn't call it a massage.
Well, yeah, it's kind of a massage. Yeah,
but I know what you're talking. It's like a really angry old woman kneading bread or something.
Like
unexpressed rage out. Yeah. Yes. But yes, I do know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's the stuff that nobody tells you that's going to happen to you. But so I had to get all of that. And because I had an epidural, I couldn't quite stand safely. So once I was all ready, got me into like a wheelchair, and they wheeled me down. And he was in like a little bassinet type thing, and like lights, and I'm hooked up to all of the machines. And that was like my very first experience with that kind of setup. And I think that's like, that can be so overwhelming in itself, like just seeing all of the things that, you know, that you have to have, really. Yeah. And mostly he did good. He had a little bit of trouble with like regulating his body temperature. He had some trouble at first with breathing, but like the oxygen came off quite quickly, and then his temperature regulated, and then he was breastfeeding, so we were able to get kind of like a rhythm in those very first few days where we breastfed a little bit, and then when we felt like he was getting exhausted, we'd do a little bit of like they had like a feeding tube that went down his throat. So we would top him off with that. And we kind of built up like this little system, which that's,
yeah.
So then I was also pumping on top of that. But, that was,
I feel like that's pretty remarkable that he was able to latch and breastfeed in those early days.
It's amazing. I credit it all to Jace's industrious nature and his like absolute need to eat. I don't know. Like my girls love to eat, but I think that they would have been like, screw this. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I can't do this. Like, feed me through the tube. But he was absolutely so determined to eat.
Yeah.
And it cracks me up because he's still that way. But
right. Yeah.
And so her and my sister was able to watch the girls and things like that. And I remember they had to go in the night. And then my husband went home to watch the girls. And there was like in the NICU, there's like a little couch type setup thing, like a little chair, maybe, if I remember right. But it's not necessarily a bed. Like not even like in the other hospitals, they have like a pillow, but this isn't really a setup for a bed. But they gave me this room, kind of like like unused wing of the community hospital. So it's just a kind of like a walk from like the NICU down this little hallway. And they gave me this hospital room, basically. But I could stay there as long as I needed while Jace was in the NICU. And I remember, you know, it was from 5 until probably 9, 10 at night. And I was going to just walk down and sleep for just a little bit and pump. And then I was going to come back. But I remember I got into that room. And, you know, when he was born and all this happened unexpectedly, there was no time to process anything that was happening. I just knew that he needed me, and anything that I felt couldn't even be there at the time. Yeah. And so I walked down there. And I remember getting settled in bed, and I made a couple phone calls to some friends and stuff that I hadn't known. But then, like, the darkness settled in, you know. It was nighttime, and I was alone. There was no one there, and everybody at that point was sleeping. I'm sure I could have called someone, but I just felt so – everything crashed into me. And I just – I felt like I was grieving somebody that I had lost. And it's even hard to say that, because it's not that I was grieving Jace – He's a gift, but I was grieving what I was expecting, totally. The baby that I had expected, the journey that I was expecting to happen.
Yeah.
And so when that kind of crashed into me, it was like these unearthly sobs. I just felt so sad and so alone.
Yeah.
It was a dark night, but
yeah,
I had to grieve what, you know, it was a process I had to go through. I had to grieve that to be able to take care of the baby I was gifted. So,
it is just so much. And like you said, when things like that happen, it's your focus as a mom does all of a sudden become so narrow. It's like you get tunnel vision, and
right.
Everything just is about what does this baby need? How, you know, it's that survival instinct and that protective instinct that just kicks in, that there, everything else falls away. Like nothing else matters right then, you know?
Right. It doesn't matter that you just pushed out a baby. None of that. Yeah. I don't even know. I don't even remember like even thinking any of it.
Right.
There was nothing, you know, like he needs me.
Yeah.
I'm fine.
And I think part of the grief in that can be, like you said, it's not like you're grieving the loss of Jace, but it's all those little things that you were expecting to have happen. And then suddenly it's this contrast and just this drastically different thing unfolding that you're totally unprepared for. And when that happens, it's like I imagine that you were like, thinking about how is this going to impact the family? What are we going to do? Like just all these thoughts probably, like you said, came crashing in.
Right.
And I feel like I relate to needing to be alone in those moments, but also feeling so incredibly lonely.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a weird conundrum that you find yourself in. Like, I feel like sometimes being with others, that it's heavier because you feel like you have to, it's just one more thing. You have to like help them through their emotions or, you know, they're experiencing their own set of experiences. And it's that can be too much when you're already going through, you're just trying to get yourself through it.
Yeah.
But also you just want someone too that, I don't know, you just want like a body to sit there and just like not need, you know, like almost like a random bystander that doesn't have any connection to it. And they can just like let you just sob and hold you and then just walk away and not have anything to do with any of it. You know, like just need like a hug buddy.
And I will say that I was so fortunate when I was going through what I did with Kai's medical stuff. Like I was so fortunate that I did have a couple of nurses who were willing to be that kind of person. Yeah. Like they would come in. I mean, I had some that definitely weren't, and that's fine.
Right.
But I had a couple of star nurses who would come in and they would like let me fall apart, and they would say like, of course you're falling apart, and be so kind and so compassionate. But then also it was like such a beautiful thing, because then they would leave, but I knew they would come back in eventually and like offer a little tidbit of comfort.
Right.
Yeah. And it is a heavy lift to like when people are there and they're, I think the other thing is like they're trying to say the right thing or not say the wrong thing. And you can sense that sort of discomfort in them. So then it's like, I would be aware of that and be sort of like wanting to help them or reassure them that I was fine, but I was so far from fine. It was like, I did eventually just have to tell my family, like, hey guys, I love you so much. I'm so glad you'll be out in the waiting room praying, but like, I can't have anyone in here. It's too much.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I completely understand that.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, that's day one, right? And then...
Yeah, that was, less than 12 hours in, really. And we were like, I guess, a little over 12 hours in. And it was just like, we hit the ground running. Like, I don't even know, like... So he was in the Missoula NICU for 5 days. And at the time, the girls couldn't come see him. So because of the... They were too young. And, you know, we were right in the middle of, like, cold and flu season and all that. And so... And it was such a... I felt so torn. Like I knew that they were okay. I mean, I missed them. They hadn't really been away from me like this. They were expecting their own things. They were so excited to come to the hospital and meet their little brother. And then that kind of crashed around them too.
Totally.
But I remember being like, I needed to focus. I couldn't focus on all of them. You know, I couldn't give everything to everyone.
Yeah.
And I felt so torn because I needed to be there with Jace. He needed me in that moment. And even if the girls needed me, it was in a way that could be helped with others, you know, then they had family and I trusted my family and they had my husband and they were okay, even if it was hard, but Jace wasn't okay.
Right.
And I just felt this constant pull. So anytime there was a couple, we were in the process of moving, of course, right in the middle of all this. So there was a couple times I did have to leave for a couple of hours, but even if it was just a couple of hours where I felt like I was just being drugged by a giant magnet and I was just trying to fight this pull back to the hospital.
Totally.
And I think that's something that not everyone understood in my life. Like, I think it's just this instinctual mothering instinct, you know, like I needed to be with him. I needed him to know that no matter all this stuff was hard. I mean, he was IVs and these x-rays and these, you know, CT scans and all the things that he was going through are stuff that like most people don't go through, you know, but then he was just, you know, this little tiny 24-hour little newborn and he was going through all this, you know, like there wasn't any like of that cozy, slow paced, you know, wrapped in a blanket where, you know, there were times that he was crying and he had to cry because I couldn't pick him up. They were in the middle of something and all I could do was, you know, let him know that I was there. And so
it's the worst.
It was just, it was just awful. It was awful.
Yeah. Yeah, but I do know that feeling of just the absolutely compelling feeling to be there and to be cheering them on and to be letting them know that, like, you know, I just remember whispering, like, hang on, you know, like really encouraging your baby. Well, like even when they're sleeping,
you know?
Yeah.
Even when they're sleeping and you're not necessarily holding them, like I didn't want to leave. I didn't want them to wake up and know that I wasn't there.
Not to mention the fact that But like you, when I think about giving birth, like it's that crossing over from the baby actually being inside you to then there's the, you know, the right. little bit of space in between. But those right. first days are meant for you still to be like attached to your right. baby. And right. even though my experience, which is so, so different, I always want to say that, but it was, we were 2 weeks out. So that's very different than like right well, but at still, birth.
That's like yeah. right in the beginning, you know?
But I mean, just when I think about how hard, like you couldn't drag me out of that hospital. And I think right. everyone really worried about that in my life. They right. thought, oh my gosh, Claire needs to leave.
She needs to give
herself a break. And I was like, are you kidding me? Do you know how much more stressful it's going to be like on my break to
right.
like to be wondering what's happening in that room? Right. Like I won't be, I'll still be in the room. You like you can exactly. take my body out, but my heart exactly. and my mind that are going to remain way. Right there in the room. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I felt like. I felt like my body might have left, but I was always in the room. Like I couldn't. It didn't help my mental health because all I could think about was how long I had to get back to him. You know,
for sure.
I totally get that. Mm-hmm. And my girls drew him pictures. And we kind of talked about how he was born different and he had little cute little mitten hands and he had, you know, he just had some differences, but he was, so when they drew him pictures, we hung him up on his bassinet. Yes. And I remember Ellie, she was just starting to really draw people, but it was like the 3-year-old, you know, with like the stick and like the 5 legs.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
But I remember she drew her family and all of us were in one color. And then Jace was this different color because she hadn't met him. And I think that in her little mind, that was her processing, like, because it wasn't like every person was a different color or like, it was like everybody, mom, dad, Scarlett, her, we were all one color. And then Jace was this different color over this little baby. And it was kind of this fun little, not fun. It was just an interesting perspective into her brain, you know, and how she was handling and how she was kind of viewing like what was happening. So 5 days in the NICU, and then he was doing great. He was feeding good. I think at that point we might have switched to sometimes bottles, I think, because the breastfeeding, even though he was doing well, was tiring him. So then he was, because it was so much harder to eat, then he wouldn't take in enough. So we were having to supplement with bottles. So I was just pumping, and then he was eating out of bottles, and he was able to get what he needed that way, which... It's just a small thing in this journey that, but I loved my breastfeeding journey with my girls, and it wasn't even something I could process back then because there just was no processing these things, but it is something that I missed out. I look back and I wish that we would have had that, especially through all of his surgeries and all of the pain. It's something that is so innately comforting for a baby to be able to be snuggled, and not that bottles are worse by any means. It's just that my experience with my girls was so nice. And I just wanted that for him. And, you know, we had the pump, the bottles and all that. And it was great. And we bonded in other ways. But that is something that I dearly missed that I didn't get to do with him. But at least we did have a little bit in the beginning because he was determined.
And that makes sense to me because it's like you knew what you were missing because you had such yummy experiences with your girls, and then also the desire to comfort and soothe and snuggle your baby when they're hooked up to a million zillion things is like times 1 million, right? So then when you can't just like unplug everything and put them up to your chest and like have that skin against skin thing, it is so hard because you feel like they need it more than ever and you need it more than ever.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, because like if you like, we were kind of talking about his initial first days, if you compare that to like even say my girls, I mean like it was slow, snuggly, the nurse only came in when needed. I mean, and then you got to go home and it was just slow and all this cuddle time and all this together time. And, you know, when they cried, you were able to just soothe them, even if sometimes newborns just cry and you can't, you know, that's a whole other ball game, but you're home and there was just this environment and that wasn't for him, you know, like he didn't have that experience. Right. And so that want to have those bonding experiences and to give him those things that he was missing, like not that he knew, but I knew. And it was just like this innate instinct to want to have him. You know, I held him all the time. And in the beginning, I remember all those cords. And in the beginning, he wasn't in the first NICU, in the first 5 days, he wasn't attached to a ton. He did have an IV, but that was just, it was still in, but it was just flushed occasionally because he was doing good eating. So he didn't have that. And he did have the pulse ox monitor, and he had this tube that went down his throat that he absolutely despised. But in those first days, it can be so overwhelming, but I just learned I wasn't going to wait. I wasn't going to wait to hold him. So even in those days, and that's not even like the remote bit hard for me now to look at those like minor things. Right. To me, those are minor things. But
yes,
back then, you know, you're not used to that. But I held him all the time, and I learned. I watched them pick him up and show me, you know, and then I didn't wait anymore. I would just, mm-hmm. I would just hold him. I would just come in and I would pick him up because I wasn't about to wait for someone to tell me when I could hold my newborn.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that there were people that just, that drove crazy, but it was my one little small rebellion about what was happening. Yeah. And so then after 5 days, they discharged us. We had like a plethora of appointments already scheduled. We had like we were going to have to go to Seattle to meet the craniofacial team. We had like an appointment with a cardiologist like 2 weeks out or something, you know, all of these things. And he was home for maybe a day and a half. And that, I think it was the second night. So he came home at night. We came home around dinner time. And then we slept. He did all right that night. And then the following night, he struggled to breathe. We just went back and forth. Like, are we supposed to bring him in? Like, is it bad enough to bring him in? Is this just his normal? I mean, like, there's no playbook. There's no playbook for any baby. But, like, for Jace, there was just absolutely no way to know what we were supposed to do. And, you know, looking back, I think we probably could have brought him in sooner, but we were able to settle him in like a propped up a bit, mm-hmm. kind of in his car seat, and he was right by my bed. And his breathing was able to be like, he calmed down and he was eating. And I was like, you know, I think he'll be okay. Let's wait till the morning. Cause in my mind also, I was thinking they didn't even know what he had when he was born.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to bring him in the middle of the night if we could wait to talk to his doctor, if that made any sense. Like, I just felt like, you know, he wasn't in any immediate harm. And I just wanted to, I don't know, looking back, I'd probably brought him in. But
well, and that's what I was going to say is we talked about this very, very steep learning curve that you go through. And one of the things is that for me, like, I had to learn to care about what was happening with us and what was happening with Kyla more than I cared about going in unnecessarily and having everyone look at me like, oh my God, like this lady can't even figure out that, you know? And I was like, I eventually had to be like, I don't care what they think of me. Like if I feel like Kyla's in danger at all, I'm going to say something. I'm going to be there. I'm going to do this.
Right. But
that comes with time because if all of your life, you've just been able to completely trust the authority of the medical professionals. And then you just think, well, then who am I to think that I can make any kind of call on this, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. The advocating, like it really isn't something that, I mean, you're born with it as a mother. There is some like, you know, the mother bear kind of like, but this, like the medical world is like, it's just a totally different cup of tea. It is something, it's one of the things, like I always say, like, I wish that I had had someone in the hospital that was able to just kind of, like a social worker or, you know, someone that came down and was like, this is what you can do if you disagree. This is what you can do if you're still worried and you don't know the answer. This is how you can request a second opinion. This is your rights as the mother and as the patient advocate. Because I had to learn all of those things the hard way. Like I had to learn by either being pushed so far emotionally that I snapped and then things actually happened, which is not the best way. But sometimes I just felt like nobody listened until they snapped. Nobody listened, you know, they thought, and there was so many times. And so, but I just wish that there would have been that one person to be like, this is how you can navigate this new world that you're in.
Right.
Because up to that point, like you said, you're kind of naive to like what goes on in the medical world. And you just kind of blindly trust that you can just, you know, you don't have to do more than usually go into the walk-in clinic or your, you know, main provider, you know, deal with all these kind of different like crazy journeys.
For sure.
But So he started breathing kind of bad. And in the morning, it seemed to get worse. He seemed to almost be getting sick. Mm-hmm. So we brought him in to the emergency room, and then they admitted him into the PICU. He was doing okay, but he had what was, I think it was the rhinovirus, which is just really like the common cold.
Yeah.
And even in babies, like certain times, I don't know what did Kyla or...
They never completely figured it out. It was like this weird combination of circumstances where they thought that she wasn't gaining her birth weight back. And then she became really, really sick and couldn't keep anything down. Right. And they thought that maybe she was intolerant. You know, this is a common thing to soy and dairy.
Right.
And so that had combined with like a stomach virus that was really bad. And because those two things were going on simultaneously and I didn't know to be avoiding soy and dairy, it was like her little system just became completely overwhelmed, and she would throw up every time I would feed her. She would throw it all up and just became really dehydrated. And so so they never quite like figured it out, you know, ran a zillion million tests while we were there, and they never quite figured it out. But
and that's like even throughout Jace's journey, I think the unknown is the worst, you know, like
the unknown is so
just
hard.
You can do something with that, but the unknown is just the hardest. That's the hardest thing to deal with in any amount of medical stuff. It's always the unknown.
Yeah. And I will say, like, we had, you know, I just part of the podcast is talking about what helped and what didn't when you're in these kinds of situations with your babies and as a new mom. And I feel like we were really fortunate to have a wonderful provider, a great doctor that we started with. And she would come in the morning, I remember, and be like, guys, I was up for hours last night trying to figure out, like researching at home on my computer. And like, I just don't know what's happening, but we'll figure it out. But like, they couldn't figure it out. And then we had another doctor,
kind of doctor
who was like,
you know?
Right. And then we had another one who like was very uncomfortable with saying, I don't know what's happening. And so there's that ego thing that factors in. And so he was much more like, well, she's probably fine. Like, let's just take her off of this, that, and the other. And like, I was like, what? You know, and it's the thing where you get, you know, all of a sudden you fall in love with your nurses and then it's their day off and you're like, what? Or when the doctors suddenly have to like, you've switched doctors altogether, like as a parent navigating that with your baby, that's so alarming because you are like, okay, well, I guess we're trusting our baby's life now with this person. Who are they? You know? And when it's that critical, it's so scary.
It's awful. I hate those switches because not only are you trying to like just survive in those moments, and then you kind of get like we've had where like, you know, say a doctor has like 2 or 3 days, you know, or even like not a whole day, but like, so you kind of get used to those people. And by the time you just kind of get to a place of being comfortable and understanding how they work and, you know, kind of the nuances of that new relationship, they're like, oh, this is this doctor now. And you're like, I can't
Here
even
we
function.
Go,
I
all
can't
over
even,
again,
like,
right?
Just can't
I know.
I have some consistency. I can't. I mean,
and
I get
kind of learn
and waiting for it off, but
you kind of learn these specialized ways of like reading your new people who are going to be taking care of your baby, and you're like, okay. It's like, I remember like being really strategic about like, how can I connect with this person? How can I appease them? How can I relate to them in a way that like they'll like me a lot? So maybe they'll care more and then they'll be more attentive. Like, I just remember being really hyper aware of like any little thing I could do to make sure that we were like in with the right people. I was going to do that.
Well, and then there were times too that I like frustration from like, say past care, like say we had 3 days of just awful experiences with said, you know, a doctor or a nurse or whatever, and then we'd switch. That frustration was hard to not carry over to the poor person that was coming on. And even if they were amazing, I always felt like, where does this frustration go? Like, I can't do it. You know what I mean? Like, this is a totally different person and they didn't do this, but I still have this, like, what happened, you know?
Right. Well, because you're at the mercy of these people. for whoever walks in the door, you're at their mercy. And that's a hard place to be when you're supposed to be the one in charge because you're the mom, right?
Yeah. You're like, you're supposed to know what's happening. You're supposed to be like the boss of the situation, you know? Yes. And it's hard to like not even know what's happening. But
yeah.
So they admitted him. They admitted him into the PICU. And thankfully the girls were able to come see him. So we were only there for maybe a day or two. He had the rhinovirus, just the common cold, but especially because of his facial structures and all that, he was really struggling. But he wasn't on like a vent or anything. He was on like, I think, high flow oxygen at the time. So that was nice that he wasn't, you know, we could still hold him and he was still aware. We didn't have to sedate him or anything. And the girls were able to come visit him in the PICU. So that was really nice because for them, it was like, they had just got their baby brother home, you know? And then I remember right before we brought Jace in, my oldest, Ellie, was holding him and she was feeding him a bottle. And you could hear that he was having a hard time. And she looked up at me and she was just like, and I was like, he's having a hard time, isn't she? Isn't he? And she goes, yeah, he is. And that was like right before we brought him in that we decided to bring him in. But it was just like, you could see the worry on her face, you know, and she's just like this 3-year-old, like she knew. And so then, you know, he had to go to the hospital. Once again, their life is, you know, up in the air. But they were able to come see him before he left for Seattle, which that was really nice that they were able to come. Yeah, because it was really hard in the NICU to have to be pulled, even though it's harder sometimes to also have them and have all of the needs, as we kind of talked about. It's hard to also not have the option to.
Mm-hmm.
But we were waiting on a bed for Seattle. He was stable and they were able to help him in Missoula, but because he had they were worried they were going to have to do a nasal procedure or a breathing surgery right away after he was done. And they knew that he had these heart issues and we already had to be, you know, set up so that we were going to be life flighted over so that we could heal there and get all of it kind of taken care of there. So we were just waiting on a bed. So he was in the PICU maybe a day and a half or 2 days. And I remember they told us we were leaving. They were like, we got a bed. You can go home and pack a bag. And then we're going to be leaving some point today. And we just left the hospital. We were coming down Reserve. We lived kind of like by Walmart. So it's like probably a 3-4 mile drive. And halfway home, and somebody calls me and they're like, you know, this is the pilot or whoever it is. We're going to be leaving here for a life flight. What time would you like to leave? And so in my mind, it was maybe, I don't even know what time it was, but say it was 9. I was thinking I would love to go home and pack a bag. And I would love to maybe take my girls out to lunch, just a brief lunch, because I haven't had a lot of time with just, you know, them. And so I was thinking, you know, maybe a couple hours, like, right? Like, give me time to, like, do that. And I said, if it was 9, I had said, like, 11 or whatever it was, to a couple hours difference. And he goes, well, nope, that's not going to work. We're going to leave in 45 minutes. And I was like, okay.
Like, I guess I'll be there in 45 minutes.
Right? Yeah. I was like, I'm not sure why there was an option given, you know, like was fine with having to leave right then, but it was a weird, just a weird way to go about it. But,
So
I flew home and then I was worried that I wasn't get back in time. It was Reserve Street traffic and stuff. So I flew home and then I was just stressed. I was stressed that I was leaving my babies. I didn't know how long we were going to be in Seattle. It was just going to be me. I threw everything in a bag, but I wasn't, you know, I'm a terrible packer to begin with. That I pack things that I, and then I get there and I didn't pack things. I don't know what happens in my brain.
it's either that or I get there and I'm like, wow, I brought everything I own. Everything. And I think that's because I'm so scared that I'm going to, because of all the times that I get there and I'm like, what was I even thinking? I brought like one sock and like a pair of pants for the next 4 days. So like, I overcompensate. Yeah.
Like 10 shirts, but like one pair of pants. And I'm like, what was I thinking?
Well, and not to mention that you are less than a week out from giving birth.
Like,
that's a whole other thing where your body, I mean, any of us
trying to heal, I don't even remember. Like,
that's a lot. Like, and I remember having the ideal situation, like after Kendall was born, my mom came and took care of Kyla. And I remember feeling like I needed to sleep pretty much constantly. And I was still exhausted.
Tired, yeah.
And so it's like, when I think about you going through all these like crazy hard decisions and like scary moments and all these things, meanwhile, like your body is like, excuse me, can I get a second? Yeah. Right. And so I know you mentioned like there were some very key items that got left out of that bag.
Yeah. Like, I think I don't even know if I brought any, or if maybe I don't even know what I was thinking, like I said, but I might have just brought like a handful of things. And obviously I wasn't even home. I mean, I was home for maybe that day. So I didn't even have time to and I wasn't expecting him. I didn't have time to do anything, to stock up on anything. We were supposed to be there in 45 minutes. I didn't bring what I needed to bring. I think I brought maybe one pair of pants. I maybe two pairs of underwear, which I ended up like washing in the sink and like scrubbing and drying because I didn't have any. It was just bizarre the way I packed. Not bizarre. I was under a lot of stress, but like I got to Seattle and I was like, okay,
need to have. And didn't you mention to me that you forgot like your debit card, like any sort of like money too? So you couldn't even go to the store and get underwear.
Yeah, we did. We just had the one debit card. My husband kept it, and I didn't have any cash. We didn't stop to get cash. I didn't nothing. So I just had this black duffel bag, arrived at the hospital, and they were just going, they were getting ready, and they had, all the awesome LifeLight nurses that are just super experienced. And Jace was in this metal box with clear sides and all hooked up, and he was just a bug in a rug, all snuggled in. I mean, it looked like something out of a futuristic film, but he was he could have cared less. And they're he'll probably sleep the whole time because the rumble of the plane and stuff. And he didn't need anything the whole plane ride, which is nice. But we got in and then off we went. And so we were just a little plane. I think there was two nurses in the back with us, the pilot. There was a seat for me, and then Jace had this bassinet. It was a big locking thing that locked his bassinet in. And it was this all the way to Seattle. And I don't usually mind that stuff, and it didn't really bother me too much. But it was we were on a turbulent sea the entire way to Seattle.
Oh, and my
I feel bad for people because I don't usually get sick, and I was pretty okay. But I was thinking about the poor people that have motion sickness, how awful this ride would have been for them.
How long was it?
It's only I think it was just over an hour. So thankfully, it wasn't terrible. I mean, it was a short-lived.
But still, that's a long time to be going through that much turbulence.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. But so we land, and immediately we're in the Seattle hospital, and they go to town. They're just getting them set up in this NICU. There's 500 people. There's all kinds of specialty doctors stopping in. And at the time, people just come in, and they're like, hi, I'm so-and-so, this is me. And then another person comes in, and they're like, hi, I'm so-and-so. And then they have all the masks and the stuff because he has contagious virus. So they're all, every time someone comes in, they have all of the stuff, which I'm sure you get. But then at one point he got better, so he wasn't contagious anymore. So then they didn't have to wear any of that. And I recognized no one. They were like, oh, you've seen me for the last week. And I'm like, were you? That was really disconcerting. I never knew, and I couldn't keep track. I couldn't keep track of who these people were. Some were nurses, some were the NICU general doctor, some were the ENT, some were the craniofacial, some were the cardiologists. And it was so much information. The first day they did a CT scan, they did an MRI, they did x-rays of his hands and feet. I mean, all of the things. It was just he was just I felt a little bit he was a science project,
Totally.
He was just this 6-7-day-old, little baby, and he was just bombarded with all of these things.
Yeah.
So we learned not too soon, not too far out, maybe the first day or two, they did an echo on his heart, and we learned that he had a pretty severe congenital heart issue. So he has what's called Schoen's complex, which is a constellation of four heart issues. And so he had a aortic arch pinch. It was his aortic arch was pinched, so he wasn't getting good blood flow to his lower extremities. He had a couple big holes in between the chambers of his heart. He has a parachute mitral valve, which currently he still has. And then he also had his aortic valve So it's supposed to be three pieces that open and shut as it goes. And his was only two. And then along with that, it was too small for his age. And then the space underneath, like the chamber size underneath the aortic valve, was too small.
Oh my gosh, Ashley.
Yeah. So, but the main issues in, and that was a lot. That was a lot to take in. Like some doctors sat down and just was like, so this is, and he had like this little black and white drawing of a heart and was like, this is kind of what Jace's heart looks like. And at the time I didn't really realize how, at the time I was just thinking he, because they were going to fix the two holes in his heart and the aortic arch. And I didn't realize the severity, I think, of Schoen's complex in general. I mean, there was just so much information coming in.
Yeah, yeah.
So at the time, we were trying to balance that Jace was sick and he was too sick to have the surgery, but he needed the surgery sooner rather than later because eventually, like, he was on a prostaglandin, which was trying to help, like, relax the arch, and he was on, we couldn't feed him, and, like, he could only eat, like, a very little amount at the beginning, and then all, and then towards the end of the, like, where we were waiting period, he couldn't eat anything. It was all intravenous, and he was so mad about that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They would do this, like a little sponge, like a dental care thing, and they would do the sponge, and he, every time they put that in his mouth, he, like, I was so sad, because then he was so mad. Obviously, he was getting nutrition, but it wasn't the way that he didn't know. Yep. You know what I mean? How is he supposed to know?
Well, and that's one of their first strong reflexes that develops is like the sucking, you know, and so it is.
And he's hangry all the time. Mm-hmm. So we went through, that was really rough. And it was just this kind of waiting period where I knew that his heart was getting worse by the day. And they were taking upper and lower extremity blood pressures to make sure that they were the same, because when his heart started to fail, his lower extremities would be lower, the blood pressure would be lower than his upper, which meant that is that blood pressure, the blood wasn't getting down there. So they were doing that every day, and it was such a delicate, and I just felt like I was in purgatory. Like I felt like I wanted them to do the surgery because I could see that he was slowly getting worse. But I didn't want him, obviously I didn't want him to have the surgery at all. I didn't want him to have this heart issue, but I wanted him to do the surgery and I wanted him to get better. And it was such this delicate balance where you're just waiting for people to tell you it's the day. And they kept saying, like, they'd come in and be like, oh, on Tuesday, that's our cardiology meet day. And we're all going to meet and we're going to come up with a plan. And it felt like such a long ways away.
Yeah.
And like, it felt like no, and I know that this wasn't the case, but it felt like from my perspective that nothing was really being done until this meeting, until this Tuesday, you know? And
That seems so backwards, right? If this is an urgent need, why are we
I felt scheduling like, let's fix it now, around
the cardiology meeting?
So that was tough. And thankfully it wasn't a super long wait. So he had, so he was like, what, 6-7 days when we got to Seattle, and then he had his surgery maybe when he was 3 weeks, because he was born on the 18th of January, and then his surgery was the day before Valentine's Day, which we've always kind of considered the new Valentine's Day. It's like New Heart Day. But so he, and my mom was able to come, so she called me, and she had met Jace like right in the beginning, but then, you know, then she was taking care of my girl. So she seen him, but she's never able to hold him or really, you know, any, you know, it was just too much. It's like everything was going on. So she called and she says, I can come out for 3 days. I can come this, you know, before, after, during, like, what do you need? And I was like, well, and this is just something that you, it's just a reality of what you have to think about, but I wish that this wasn't the case, but like, I was like, well, what if he doesn't make it through surgery? Like, what if, because that's a very real, I mean, a lot of risks and he's little, you know? And I was like, so, you know, why don't you come before and hang out with us and spend some time, you know? And I mean, it's just like, I wasn't even thinking about my needs. I wanted her to be able to have this time in case this was the only time we had. And so she did. She came out, she flew out for a few days, and it was really nice. She took me to Walmart. And so, and that was kind of surreal, like we talked about. It's like you kind of enter the world again, like in the hospital, you're like in this bubble. And then when you enter the world again, all these people are just bustling around and all their lives seem to just be the world just continues on, and but you're like stuck almost in this place, and like this, your life is just like upturned, and you're in all this trauma, and you're like, what is happening? Like, how, it's such a surreal experience to re-enter the world.
Yeah.
It's such an immediate flip, I feel like. It's like there's a before you and an after you, and the before you couldn't possibly understand what the after you is dealing with. Like, it's just such a strange, you're like a totally different person than you were.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. Almost like you took glasses off and now you can kind of see. It's,
But you did get some underwear.
I did. And I got some supplies. I actually, right before she came, so, you know, Jace was hooked up to all the stuff. And in the beginning, when you're hooked up to so many things, the nurses are like, if you want to hold him, you have to just tell me and I'll help you. And eventually, even in that hospital, I just completely bypassed that regardless. But in those beginning days, I was, you know, recovering from birth. I was bleeding. I had not enough for what I was going through. I think I actually had to, I actually asked the social worker if they had any when I first arrived, because I don't think, like, not looking back, I don't think I brought anything. I think I just had was on my body.
Yeah.
They were able to provide me with some things, which was very good. Nice. Yeah. But I remember the one time, so I asked to hold him, and, you know, they kind of, they're busy. I get it. They're busy, but, they make you almost feel as if you're a small child that's asking for another cookie, you know? And you're just like, I just want to hold him. And they're like, well, if I do this and it's going to take me this time to get him, you know, settled, I don't want to come back in here in 10 minutes, basically. I mean, they say it in a slightly nicer way, but not really. And some nurses are not like that. I will say that. They're phenomenal people in the medical field. Yeah. I have had phenomenal experiences. There are also those that I wish maybe had chosen a different profession.
Amen. I'm on that.
But I'm holding him, and I can feel that however I'm situated isn't working, and the menstrual stuff is not where it's supposed to be, or it's overflowing or whatever. And I bled through, I think, the only pair of pants that I had. And that was that particular nurse that I was like, I called her in, and I was, you know, I kind of explained what was happening, and I'm like, I'm so sorry. And I had to clean the chair. And I just remember feeling like she'd never gone through anything. Like, you know, she's a woman too. And it just felt like it was such a strange, she didn't make me feel better about what had happened. And then I think I had to call a social worker and be like, these are the only pair of pants I have. You know, is there something I could just wear until I can get these washed and I can give them back? Or is there like a pair of scrub pants or, you know, something that I can wear in the meantime? But it felt so dehumanizing in a way, like I was dealing with all of this stuff to begin with. And then that's silly that I'm going to cry about that one thing, because obviously there was harder things. But
no, but the thing is, though, those are such missed opportunities of offering support that is not complicated. It's very simple. But if you had someone in that moment be like, oh, it's okay. Like, it's just a chair. Like, I'm sorry that happened. Are you all right? You know,
what can I get you,
anything just to make you feel less embarrassed, because that's a vulnerable moment. And anytime we're so vulnerable like that, like we really just need a friend. We just really need someone to be warm to us.
Right. To like act like I, you know, and it's not as if like that kind of stuff usually doesn't like get to me, you know. I know that we all go through it,
right,
and, like, it happens,
but I mean,
like, it was, I knew no one, you know, I didn't know these people. It was a very like public area, and I felt so vulnerable. Like, so I just felt so like I had to ask these people for help, and then that help felt begrudging, like they gave it begrudgingly, you know. And that just felt silly. I was like, you know, at the time I was maybe a week and a half out from giving birth to my third baby, and like I was like, how dare I think about myself, you know what I mean? Like, it almost felt like that. I felt like almost like chastised for even like not taking care of the things I needed to take care of along with everything else, you know. There was that. But so she came, and she was able, I was able to get some pants and some underwear and some like supplies. I think I even got like some fingernail clippers because my fingernails were long. I mean, she just got me like things that you don't even think about, like, because I also didn't know.
Totally.
And we were gonna, you know, we were kind of looking at a long time at this point now that we knew his heart stuff. And so, you know, that kind of wasn't on my radar in the beginning.
Yeah.
But
is it common for, Is it common for those heart complications to come alongside Apert syndrome? Like, are those, do they go hand in hand sometimes?
Yeah, yes and no. So it is common to have that core morbidity in Apert syndrome, to have heart defects, but it's not guaranteed. It's kind of like, I think those with Down syndrome also have like a relationship with heart issues, but not every kiddo with Down syndrome has heart issues. And it's the same with Apert syndrome. So we know a handful of people that their kids also have Apert syndrome and heart issues, but not, it doesn't come with every kiddo. And it's a range of different defects also. It can range from anything from just a hole that closes over time and they just kind of monitor, to all the way up to like, you know, like the whole left side of the heart is affected, or like Jace's whole thing, like different severities. But yeah, it is semi-common. It's not unheard of, and it is considered kind of like, they kind of go hand in hand in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
did you go through emotions? Let me ask you this, Ashley. Did you go through times where you felt angry? Like, why is this happening to my kiddo? I think it's hard to not go through that, even if you don't decide to like entertain that. Like, it is for me, that was a, like, why? Like, and I remember being like, can I switch places with her? Like, can I be the one that all this stuff has to happen to?
You know? Yeah, I was so angry that he had to go through all this. And then the more that we found out, the more he had to go through. I felt like it was just this never ending, like, to look ahead in his future felt devastating. And it was not for me, it was devastating for him. I couldn't believe that he was going to have to go through all of these things as just a tiny, you know, things. People, he's gone through most in his short life than most will ever go through. And and it's not over. And so there's moments then, but also moments now, where I just am so pissed off at the world and whatever. Like, and I think my biggest pet peeve, and I know that people don't know what to say, and I know they don't know, this is the thing that really, I hate it. I hate it when people say God gives those special kids to special parents, because there's so many things that I don't like about that statement, but the main one is that that's not true. There are kids given to parents every day that don't step up, and those kids are in foster care, or they're orphans, or they get, you know, bare minimum. It's, and I'm not tooting my own horn by any means. I just did what I was supposed to do, and, you know, what instinctually I should do. And I love him like 1,000 times over, and I wouldn't change him. I'd change the pain he had to go through, but I wouldn't change him.
Totally.
But I can't stand that. I can't, or that his journey is, he's here to teach others a lesson. I can't handle that. I don't, he is a small kid, and he does not need to go through this so that you can learn a lesson.
There are other ways
to learn a lesson. I just, those particular things really grate against me.
I hear that.
And I know that people mean well. I know that that's not technically what they're saying. I know they're just trying to make sense of a senseless kind of situation.
No, but it's helpful to teach people in these kinds of scenarios, like, what words are supportive and what words are really hard to hear as a mom and as a parent. Are there things that people say that feel really good, or ways that people act that, like, are supportive too?
So I think that in my situation, in particular for me, I have had people that don't ask me what I need, they just do. So they, care boxes were sent, or they, you know, send me this. I had a mom and her daughter, I used to work with the mom, and they sent me this Wreck-It journal. I don't know if you've ever seen them, because I've seen them since.
Yeah, my kids have those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she sent me one of those, and she just sent, like, they sent a whole care box. They knew that I crocheted, and they just got me some yarn, and got me some hooks, and got me like a book to read, and they got this Wreck-It journal where you could take your anger out on the pages or whatever.
Yep.
And it's stuff like that. I think the actions for me more so, because there's not a whole lot to say. It's not going to be okay. And there are moments where it's, another thing with special needs parenting in particular is, it's not a phase, you know, like, life is going to look pretty hard for the foreseeable future, if not the whole life for some people. And some people don't know, like, we still don't really know what Jace's future kind of looks like, as, you know, with his other diagnoses of autism and ADHD. We don't know what his life looks like outside of this. There are those with Apert syndrome that you know, have minimal surgeries and continue on their life and are able to live a pretty typical life. And they're, you know, aside from physical differences, they're, you know, they have jobs or they become doctors or whatever it is, and they are capable of doing those things. And then there's, you know, like a spectrum of different things that, you know, 8-foot kiddos kind of go through. So there's all the way from there up to like, you know, kiddos that have to kind of live in an assisted living area with vents and things. And so it affects them differently.
Yeah.
So it's hard to know what to say because there's not a lot you can say.
Right.
That I haven't already said or I haven't already felt or...
Yeah.
I feel like I'm here and I, you know, I'm not going to leave, or if I need, you know, what's your hardest time of the day? I'll be there to help you if it's not invasive, or, you know, just doing. I have a really hard time accepting help even now after this hard journey. Yeah. I'm always just going to be like, I'm okay. I can do it.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to offer a meal or you want to do something, do it. Don't ask me, because I'm always going to say, you know, I'm always going to be like, no, thank you. That's amazing. You're great. But no, thank you. You know, I got it. And it's not, and that's part of me that probably I need to heal. Like that's that just stubborn, you know, I will do it myself and I will die trying.
Yeah. But, yep. Working on that myself. That, yeah.
Yeah.
It is. Definitely. I mean, it is the doing, because it's not only like that's helpful, but it's also this way when I've had friends show up for me like that, it's this way of just saying like, we see you. Like,
exactly.
Without you having to do anything, like we see you, we know that you're going through it. We know this would be helpful. This is something that I know would help me if I were in your situation. So here you go, you know, and so there we'll is just,
do it. Yeah.
Yeah. There's just so much grace in that. Yes.
That's kind of, it's not about what you say, it's about what you do. And to not put any more choices on someone's already overloaded plate.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, and it's like, it's putting the pressure on if someone asks, like, let me know if you need something, or, you know, like, can I do this or whatever? It's forcing you to admit that you need help, even when you really don't want help. And that's like, what's so hard is like, you know, I'm thinking here, like, don't make me say it.
Exactly.
Who knows?
And to me too, it's like, if they're like, let me know if you need help, I don't feel like imposing on your life, even if your life is technically not as hard as mine currently. Like, if you offered, you know, but like, I can't. Right. I can't impose myself. And then also, if you say, you know, can I do this? All I can think about is, well, that's going to make, you know, I don't want them to have to pay. It's just silly. Like, all the things that went through my mind, I just wish that you'd just be like, I'll do it.
Right.
You know?
I know. Yep. Yeah. There's a cooler on your porch. And end of story. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Well, so then, you know, I know Jace has been through how many surgeries since that time?
19. And his 20th is not this Friday, but next Friday. So almost 20. And there have been some rough ones. He's had a lot of major surgeries. So he had his first heart surgery in Seattle when he was 2.5-3 weeks old. Then he had a couple nasal surgeries when he was 4 months old. He had his second open heart surgery when he was 8 months old, and he was in congestive heart failure. He had a cranial reconstruction distraction surgery when he was 9 months old. He had his distractors and all that stuff removed when he was 1.5 years. He had ear tubes. He's had, like, you know, the minor things, ear tubes. I call them minor. They're not minor to some people, and I totally understand that. There was this moment where Jace was 4 months old. He was going in to get one of his nasal procedures done, and I remember we were in like this pre-surgery waiting area, but they had just the curtains, you know, and so you could see other people. Mm-hmm. And there was a mom, mm-hmm. and she had this little boy. He might have been around 1.5 years or so, and he was going in because he'd swallowed a quarter, and they needed to get it. It wasn't passing, so they were just going to go in. And for a second before I talked to her, I remember thinking to myself, I wish that was what Jace was going through. And then I watched, they took him, and I seen her face just crumble. And I thought to myself, it's never easy. It doesn't matter what they're going through. And it was like kind of like this eye opening. It doesn't matter how hard it is or how rough it is. It's like when you have to let your baby go, that's hard enough, you know? And so I just remember that, because I remember thinking, and it was like immediate karma was like, come, like, look at this. Like, you are wrong.
Totally.
And
I was totally
wrong. I mean, not that I do wish that Jace had minor issues.
Right.
But, It wasn't hard. It wasn't easier for her to let him go.
Totally.
But yeah. So yeah, he's had a lot. We've almost lost him. He developed malignant hypothermia when he was... So at that point, he might have had like 7 surgeries. So malignant hypothermia is where you are allergic to the anesthetic gas. And it can be deadly. Like, it happens, it comes on all of a sudden, it can stop your heart, it raises your temperature through the roof, and if you can't get any of that under control, you die.
Yikes.
Went through 7 surgeries. No real issues. Occasional fevers, but that can be pretty common with the surgeries he's had. Nothing major. And then he went in to get, he was going to have a front orbital advancement. It was after me and my husband separated. So that was in 2020. Of October, and he was 2, almost 3, and I remember I got settled in the surgery waiting room. Surgery was supposed to be about maybe 6 hours. 2 hours in, I see the surgeons come around the corner, the surgeon and his plastic surgeon and the neurosurgeon, and I can see on their face that it's not, I mean, they're not supposed to be there to begin with. But then they also brought me into this room, and usually they just come. If it's going to be something, they just come. They brought me into this room, and I was alone. And they sat me down, and they said, I just want you to know that he's okay now. And I listened to them talk about how they kind of went into this conversation, how they were doing the incision, so they opened up across ear-to-ear incision, and they were just about to make the bone cut to do all that, and... his heart stopped. And up until that point, I felt it. I was worried. But up until that point, it was holding it together. But when I heard that his heart stopped, I just couldn't keep it together. Like, I was just a mess. And they said that they were... I can't remember. It wasn't the kind of heart stop where they have to shock you. It, you know, they were able to do compressions. And they got his heart rate back. And then it stopped again. And they were able to get him back again. And he was in the ICU at the time that they were talking to me. They didn't close up his wound. They just wrapped. They just kind of stapled quickly and wrapped him and got him to the ICU to get stabilized. His fever was through the roof. They had him on like a cooling blanket, and it was still in the like 102, 103, even with medicine and on a cooling blanket. But he presented differently. So at first we had no idea what was happening. So usually malignant hypothermia results in a fever right away, and then it's gone. But he presented differently. So at first they didn't know what was happening. He started to stabilize over the next, he was on a vent and sedated. He started to stabilize over the next 12 hours, and they decided to bring him back into the OR just to close this the way they should. And it happened again. The heart stuff didn't, thankfully, but he was only in the operating room for maybe 20 minutes. They came back out and his fever was back up and all. He had all these other symptoms. And they had like the disease team come in and they said, I think he has this weird presentation that of hypothermia, but we almost lost him. And that was probably the hardest day of my life.
Yeah.
And the hardest week. And I remember when he was on the vent and... they were waiting for him to be able to breathe on his own, and he was fighting the vent, so they had to keep him sedated, but the sedation was causing his breathing to not be where it should be. But anytime he would get scared of the, you know, and then start to, and then his stats would plummet because he was holding his breath and he was terrified. And I just remember, it just happened over and over and over again. And I just remember, I was like, I don't think you need to continue to sedate him. Something is happening. It's almost like he's getting a clog, you know, in his tube. And so he's like, I keep watching him and it keeps happening. And I don't think like sedating him isn't the issue. You know, that's not the answer. It's just continuing this process. And, but nobody listened to me. They're like, oh, we have to, blah, blah, blah. And finally, it happened again, and I couldn't. I had been there for days. Yeah. It can happen over and over. And I threw my shoes on in like a fit. And I was like, nobody, you know, and I just flipped a little bit, you know, like I said some unkind words, I'm sure. And I just kind of stormed out of the room for a minute and walked around the hall because I just couldn't take it anymore. Like I couldn't take that this was happening over and over. And they listened. There was one nurse that took my took what I said and she listened and she said, you know, I'm going to start suctioning him when this happens. Like, I'm going to suction and we're going to see what's happening. And that was what it was. He was getting like almost like it, he was waking up enough and he was moving his secretions and then it would get clogged and he would panic. And then this whole cycle would continue over again. And, but that one nurse finally listened to me and she took my, what I said, and that was it. So eventually we were able to get out of there, but my.
Cause I mean, the thing is like nurses know what they know and doctors know what they know, but when you are sitting next to your kiddo all day, every day, watching them so closely, like that's valuable information.
It is.
That should not be taken lightly. It's not like you're sitting back like watching TV and suddenly come up with this notion that maybe it's something that nobody has thought about.
But, like, I'm just like off, you know, in a Ronald McDonald House Googling all the symptoms but not actually seeing him, you know, like watching what's happening.
Right. And if, and it's like him. If it's anything outside of what anyone's familiar with, there's like there's no validity to it. Exactly. And it's like, well, no, but I can see what's happening and I've watched it happen now over and over. And I like, please just give it a shot.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah.
And you know, the dumb thing about the whole thing is that it has happened in those, like those kind of situations where nobody listened to what I had to say. And then finally they listened and it was what it was the whole time. And
yeah.
It's happened so often that it's really seriously damaged the trust that I have in the medical world in general. And, you know, I was talking to another special needs mom and I said, I have like this medical anxiety. I worry, you know, too much, I think. And I think like maybe it's something and it might not be. And she goes, it's not medical. She was so reassuring. She said, it's not medical anxiety. It's your experience and all of the things that you've been shown and all of the things that you know about Jace, and you're advocating for him, and that's what you're doing. You're not having like this crazy anxiety. You're just being his mom, and you know what you know. And so it was very reassuring because I felt like I was going a little bit crazy recently. Like, you know, am I just seeing things where there aren't things to see? I mean, because we live a crazy life a little bit, you know? So,
well, gosh, it's hard to know where to go from here because there's so much more to Jace's story. But I do want to make sure that we kind of focus on, like, I got to meet Jace the other day. These poor listeners, you know, I didn't have that privilege, but he's such a cool, such a sweet kid. And one thing that was cool to see about your interactions is, like, we said you speak Jace.
Yes.
Because, you know, he's still learning how to speak. And so that's something that you, as his mom, like my kiddo, my 11-year-old Kyla is 11 now. And she started babysitting. She came home the other day from babysitting a 3-year-old. And she was like, I have no idea what that kid was saying to me like the whole time. And I was like, oh, that's because you're not the mom. Like, I got you. She's like, the brother knew. I couldn't understand a word. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's what happens. Like when you're around someone who's learning how to talk, you learn their language before the rest of the world does. But just he just had this cool, sweet curiosity about him, and the two of you are so connected still to where like he needed to be just in the same vicinity as you.
Very much. Yeah.
You know?
I tell people he's got like an umbilical cord that's still attached.
Yeah.
You know? Like he always senses if I'm not, even if I'm not on the same floor as him, he senses it immediately. And I go downstairs, I can hear him run, "Ma! Ma!"
I mean, that makes sense, right? With everything you guys have been through.
Yeah. Yeah.
But will you kind of like tell us a little bit about what it was like to go from like needing such critical care over and over for that period of time to kind of like sort of feeling like things stabilized a little bit at one point? And what did it look like going from having to be, you know, out of state and having that really hyper specialized care to like eventually coming back to Missoula and establishing care there? Like what was that like to once you sort of were back home, I guess?
Right. Between like the NICU in Missoula and the NICU and all of that in Seattle, we were there for maybe 6.5-7 weeks, I think. So it went from it was just kind of a strange experience. I went from, now thankfully we were sent home with like a pulse, like a medical grade pulse ox monitor and all the, and like a suction and things. So I felt in that way more prepared. At least I had these tools specifically to help him, but it felt, it went from like having people that knew exactly, not exactly, but like they were more, it was a, you know, like a learning hospital. There was all of these they've seen Apert syndrome before. So, you know, even though we struggled there in our own ways, there was this reassurance almost. And also, I say this a lot too, like when we've stayed in a hospital for a long time, you kind of get, you feel safe in this, you kind of get in a safe little bubble. And not just in the terms of like the medical aspect of it, but more so in the terms of people accept Jace for exactly who he is. They love him. The nurses come in and there's no awkwardness. Like there's no stares, there's no awkward, you know, things that happen on the playground. And so I think the first time that happened was like we were in the hospital for, you know, basically his whole first 7 weeks or whatever. And I remember the first time we went out into public, like when we got home, and it just felt like, I've since developed just like a tunnel vision. I don't think I make eye contact with anybody. People are like, oh, I see you in the store. And I'm like, I don't see anybody in the store. Like tunnel vision, just because it's better in that way. But because people are curious, they haven't, you know, it's not often that you see someone that has the things that Jace has going on. And so I don't mind the, you know, curiosity. I don't ever mind, you know, questions that come from a kind place, but it was definitely shocking in that way. More of a surreal experience than even me going to the Walmart for the first time, like that kind of surreal. It was just, I felt like we were on display all of a sudden. At the time I had, you know, Ellie was 3 and Scarlett was about to be 2 and just turned 2, and Jace was just this tiny newborn, and he was, he had an oxygen tank and oxygen when we came home. And so like, we were just like this walking, I felt like we were just on display on the spotlight all the time. And so even if people wouldn't, I would have been able to drape a car seat, then I had like these two little bitties and then the oxygen tank and the pulse ox monitor. And I definitely was not like something that you could ignore. And I felt like that. And then as far as care, I had a great care team. We had a great pediatrician in Missoula, and she was just very much, and then even her office was just, because it wasn't just her, it was like the office people. And I could send a message and immediately somebody would call me. I could be like, I'm, you know, is this something I should? And then they'd be like, you know what, come bring him in. They squeezed him in at any given moment. They never made him wait. They were just like, let me see him. I'll, and I will forever be grateful for that, because in those early days, there were so many things that he went through, you know, whether he got sick or he got, you know, he had some, and they just, they never made me wait. They always wanted to see him. And that was such a, it wasn't just like, oh, you should bring him to the ER, you know, where these people don't know him. It was like, let me, you know, I will make time out of my day. And I know that she was busy. I know that they were busy, but they always made time for him. And I will forever be grateful. I mean, I feel like we knew everybody on a first name basis. We would walk in, you know, like the troops, and then people would be like, oh, hey, you know, because they all knew us. We were in the office probably every, you know, a couple times a week in the beginning with different things, and then also like walk-ins and stuff. So
like the mental peace that must have given you of like, even when you're, it's that thing where if you know that you have solid support behind you, even if things are going pretty well for a long time and you don't need to call upon them, like you still know that they're there.
Exactly.
And you still know that there are these people who are good at their jobs and they care deeply. And if anything does go awry, you know, in a second, like there will be someone there to help. And that I think is so huge, because it is really scary to all of a sudden be like, okay, well now it's up to me to like figure out. I mean, there's some like power in that too, right? That you have taken away from you, but also like, oh my gosh. Yeah. So I think that's, it's huge to have support like that.
Yeah. It was really beneficial. I don't know if I would have made it through those weeks if I hadn't had a good team of people that knew what he needed and were able to make the space for it. Because I, you know, there are those I'm sure that couldn't or wouldn't feel comfortable. And I just definitely grateful for that support.
And then you guys, in terms of like, you know, if there are any parents listening or anyone who might be able to take away some things other than just like complete emotional comfort from hearing someone else's story, are there some practical things that you would share with parents who are navigating like complex medical needs for their kiddos? And what are some things that have been really helpful to you, both in terms of like resources that exist that you can call upon, but then also just like, what do you talk about when you talk with other parents who are in similar situations? What are some like tips or advice that you would give?
So as far as like resources in the community, so there are a few. So we have been connected to family outreach since Jace has been born, and it's called something different. It's early intervention before 3 years old, and then it's family outreach after that. I think it's all family outreach, but the program names are different. They've been really phenomenal. They have someone that's like a family support specialist. They come into the home. They help you connect to resources that you might not know. Or, you know, they've helped us get like funding for glasses because Jace broke or hid his glasses a certain number of times and we just could not keep up with his. So they've helped with that. They've helped get like sensory type equipment and things like that. They help with research. I mean, they're really just like a open-ended person that you can just talk to about your situation, but also that is able to take that and transform it into things that might actually help, like actual resources. So that's been a huge thing. We've kept
him great.
Yeah, we've kept him, you know, since he's been born. And there have been months where I really haven't needed anything from them or had anything, or even, but just having that person to come in, and that was like, we just really have loved that. So there's that. As far as like travel and things, the Jaden Fred Foundation, I forgot to mention that, but the Jaden Fred Foundation within Montana helps with different medical things, travel, different things like that. They're a huge, huge resource and we've used them in the past. There's also Angel Flights are a national thing, but they can get you medical travel, like on an airplane to appointments. And it can be just as minor as having like, not minor, but like having a second opinion. They'll pay for a flight to get a second opinion on anything.
That's awesome.
Yeah. They're really amazing.
That's so great. Yeah.
So there's that. We've used those in the past as well. As far as what I tell parents is that connect with a group. Like, so it meant the world to me. We have so Apert syndrome is extremely rare. It's like 1 in 80,000 to 120,000 births. Like nobody in the hospital when he was born had even seen it. I think in relation, like Down syndrome is like 1 in 600 or something. Mm-hmm. So like just to compare like how crazy rare it is. But there is a group on Facebook of families that have Apert kiddos, and there's like 1,000 members.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And so I was able to connect with that pretty soon on. I just typed it in. And I think that finding that kind of community, whether it be for autism or Apert syndrome or craniosynostosis or heart, there's Little Mended Hearts is a great group. They also do resources and community outreach and things, but they have like a group of families within Montana that are going through heart issues, and you know, you can ask questions or just, you know, like bounce off, like if you're worried about something, you know, those are the people that are going to be like, you know, you're going to be okay, and then this is what you can do, and this is what we did, or we've been through it.
Yeah,
that's huge. I wouldn't have made it without the group that we had. It was so nice to not feel so alone, and to have within that group community, we had babies that were born around Jace's time. So then I had a little group chat going with these three other amazing mamas, and their babies are the same age as Jace. And so we would go, like, they would be up in the middle of the night. You could text them at any time. Like it was, you know, worries or whatever. And it was such a great thing to have when he was little and we were just going through it, because I don't know how he would have survived otherwise. Yeah. So I would definitely do that. I mean, reach out. There are resources in communities, but also if there's not, like if you're feeling like you're alone and rare, you're never alone. I'm always willing to reach out to anyone. I mean, like special needs doesn't have to be what Jace has, but there are so many communities out there. You can find your people, even if they're not right here. So
yeah. And I'll also just tell folks who are listening, you know, that your Facebook page, Ashley Watson, You do a lot of writing, and you've done that for like therapeutic reasons and also just keeping people kind of in the loop. But when I was researching you / creeping on your Facebook page, like I do, but you know, it's really cool to see sometimes how different families express what they've been through. And I think that that is something that even people, if they're not wanting to, sometimes it takes energy and courage that we might not have to like actually engage in a conversation. I still encourage people to do it. But if you're like having a day where like, no, even just reading someone's, like your posts are pretty, they're really beautifully written, and just like you're very articulate in how you've described your experience. And so I think that can be helpful too. But maybe we'll put a link to the Facebook group that you mentioned, just in case there's anyone who could benefit from that. And yeah. Oh, and then when you were talking about the Angel Flight, I also just wanted you to, one of my favorite parts of your story is when you were really nervous to fly back, and you had such a cool, like, I don't know, bright angel moment, I guess.
Like, so when we were flying back, Jace was, you know, 6-7 weeks old. He had like oxygen. We had a portable oxygen concentrator, and I was nervous to sit next to, you know, you're cramped in these little seats, and he was
because this is just a commercial flight, right? Like Angel Fund just covers like it's not like a private like light flight type situation. You're just on a plane with a bunch of other folks playing who am I gonna sit next to lotto.
So he was a lap baby. I had all of this equipment with me, and I was just so worried about who was gonna have to sit next to me, and like trying to balance all, you know, newborn and his pulse ox and his oxygen. I was like, this is gonna be terrible. And this lady sat next to me, and she was amazing. She was like a retired doula or a retired midwife or something along those lines. And she was amazing. She was so patient, and she was just, she talked to us and she talked to Jace, and we were not weird or abnormal in her eyes. And she just made my flight so much more. It took all my worry away. You know, of all the things I had to worry about, I didn't have to worry about that. And she, I just am really grateful that the karma lined up and I was able to sit next to such a an amazing human, because it could have went sideways for sure.
I mean, even as like, even if I'm flying by myself, which I rarely fly anywhere, but let's say I'm flying by myself, you still have that thing of like, oh, who am I gonna get sat next to? And then if you have a child with you, a baby, for sure, you're like, oh God, like, who am I going to get? But then you had all of these other like equipment things. Like, I'm like, I even remember being like, oh my gosh, like, how am I going to manage the snacks and like the teething toy and nursing? And like, that all seems like a lot, but you had way more than that. And so to have like a compassionate person who totally understands next to you is gold.
I wish I remembered her name, but
That's okay. We love her. I bet she's feeling warm for no reason at all right now. But but yeah, and so gosh, it's hard because we do have to wrap up pretty soon. Yeah. But I just I'm just really grateful that you would come on and share your experience. And I think that, you know, it's interesting, our listeners don't get to see video, although we're really looking into that. But when I got to meet with you before we are recording today, like I got to see a couple of your kiddos in their natural homeschool environment when mom's trying to have any kind of a sort of ongoing conversation that not with them. But I just, it was cool to see, like, I think you were wearing a shirt, Ashley, that said everybody communicates differently or something like that. And then you had to move downstairs because everybody was causing so much ruckus. And you moved downstairs, and not long after, Jace joined you downstairs. But you had you had another banner up down there, and it said it was something that reminded me of your shirt. Do you remember what it says?
Was it a poster? Did it say like your superpower is being you is your superpower or something like that?
You're the only you, and that's your superpower, or something like that. And I like, it's like those little glimpses that you get into people's lives. Like, it showed me kind of how you guys roll as a family, which is like, we've got a lot going on. Like you say, you'll be the first to admit it's very hectic, it's very chaotic. But I think what's unique about you and probably a lot of families who have so much on their plate and have such full, busy lives is like, you have learned to be absolutely present in what is immediately in front of you.
Yeah.
Because that's like the only way,
it's the only way to
you can do it, right? But even when I think about you shopping with little kids in the grocery store, which can be a nightmare for any of us, right? Like it's like, oh my gosh. But the choice that you made early on to like just completely zone everyone else out and focus on these three little people who really need you. Like you don't have time to be worrying about people giving you weird looks, right? Like you only have so much energy and attention. Right. And for you, it has been required that you put it, you place it all on these kids.
Right. Yeah. I don't have any extra to be worrying about Susie and her, you know, side eye.
you don't. But what's cool is your kids are learning through watching you.
Yeah.
That like the people who deserve your attention are the people who need it and who love you and who are part of your immediate circle. Yeah. And like, and the Susie side eyes can just like disappear because they don't matter. And if you were a mom or, and I mean, this would be hard, I'm sure. But if you were someone who was really accustomed to making sure that everyone around you was approving or something, and we all become conditioned to do that sometimes.
Right.
You know, your kids would also develop that sort of self-consciousness that they do not have because they haven't, they've seen you just make the choice to not include that in their lives. And so it's cool.
Yeah, they are very much wholly themselves in any situation, regardless of if that might be.
Right. I mean, but it's like you said, and I think even for people who see that, like for people who are onlookers or whatever, to see that, like, however they're interpreting what they're seeing, like, that has nothing to do with you. Like, you guys are, like, doing your thing, and that's it.
We are.
You know, and I think that's a really, just a beautiful, I can tell that as a mom, you're very, very strong in that confidence and in what you guys have been through, and it's just really cool. Yeah, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't feel that way always, but I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're a human.
Yeah, it's
also
true.
So. Yeah. So, yeah. And then I mean, I guess I just want to end on one thing I think is important is like, how do you take care of yourself as a mom? Like, how do you give yourself moments of love and grace and comfort? And, you know, you still have a lot going on and these people need you. How does Ashley take care of Ashley?
So I will say that part of my self-care, I think, would have been ending my first marriage. And before that, there wasn't a whole lot of me ever. I think that special needs parenting really kind of exasperates what is wrong or different or not working in a relationship, and good or bad, I think. But I think that was part of it. I think that we are living better lives, healthier lives, the both of us now. And it was really difficult. But now I am married, I've been married. And that man is a godsend. If you believe in that, I don't. But is karma sent? I don't know. he allows me to have those spaces to... Before, there was just no way for me to... I don't know. I didn't even know how. And meeting him and him, like, he like kind of taught me how to take the time or how to voice what I needed or, you know, like to tell someone, hey, I'm just overwhelmed and it's not about you. I just need a minute or, you know. So nowadays it looks a little different. My stepdaughter lives with us. So she's 20, almost 21. So she's able to like kind of be here as a body while the kids are sleeping. So we get out occasionally to go do pottery together. Like we go throw some pots on the wheel.
Cute.
So
I love that.
Yeah. So that's really cool. And then the kids are gone every other weekend. And while that's, it's kind of funny because like I miss them and I want them all the time, but it's nice to have those 2 days every other week that's really nice. And I think it's good for their father too. Like, even though we don't have like half and half, you know, I really think that he is able to just focus on what he needs. And then when they're with them, it's just good all the way around. And then it's the same here. Like, I get those little breaks in between, and that's not obviously the answer for everybody. Like, hey, divorce and get your time. But
no, but I mean,
I think I definitely think that, you know, being with the right person is a huge, changes everything. So we do like pottery, and I read books when I'm doing therapy, which like when I'm at therapy with Jace, I started reading books because I realized I can't just curl up with a book and sink myself in for 6 hours. My house would not be standing. So I've decided that if I just carry a book with me, I can, you know, take those 10 minutes. And so that's been something I've been doing to kind of escape a little bit.
Yeah, that's great. Good. Well, thank you for coming on. Yeah. And I wish we had all the time in the world, but I just so appreciate it. And I know this will be helpful for people. So
yeah, thanks for having me. It's been good.
Mother Love is hosted by Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies, the Montana Coalition, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the health and well-being of families who are expecting or raising little ones. Opinions and views expressed in these interviews do not necessarily represent the views of HMHB as an organization. We sincerely value the lived experiences shared on Mother Love, and we understand that not everyone will agree with or relate to all of what is shared. Mother Love exists to help our guests and listeners honor and embrace their own stories and experiences. If the content in this episode has caused you concern or distress, please reach out to someone you trust for support. Speaking up about our struggles is half the battle, sometimes more than half, and there are many providers who can and want to help. Visit our statewide online resource guide at www.hmhb-lifts.org to help you find resources in your area.
Thank you to our incredible editor and producer, Brooke Boone Miller, for sharing her gifts with us. She's a mom, and she gets it, and for that we are so grateful.